You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 20, Shaving the Head. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including William Shatner's official Bohemian Rhapsody video, Five-Year Mission's Errand of Mercy, Microsoft's holodeck technology, John DeLancey reading The Raven, the Roddenberry Foundation's $5 million gift to the Gladstone Institutes, and how Star Trek is just around the corner. In the feature, we'll be discussing the turning point of Deep Space Nine, The Way of the Warrior. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Oh, I'm doing not too bad. I slept about 12 hours last night, so hopefully I have recovered from my busy week and I'm ready to talk some Star Trek.
Well, 12 hours. That's quite a lot. Now, how much do you sleep during the week? Like 3-4 hours a night?
Well, that's what it ended up being. Thursday night, I actually went, let's see, let me back up a little bit. Some of you may remember the Nemesis or the Star Trek Nemesis video that I made a couple months back that took the Jonathan Coulton song Nemesis and cut it together with Star Trek Nemesis. So the guy who did that song with Jonathan Coulton has a band. His name's John Roderick. His band is called The Long Winters, and they played a little show in Seattle here on Thursday night. And so I went to see, and actually after the show I had the pleasure of meeting John, and it was wonderful. He actually remembered the video and had some really great things to say about it, which really pleased me. So if you haven't checked out the video, it does now have the John Roderick seal of approval. And
we'll do that as like a video overlay. We need to create a seal of approval and stick that on.
Just a little silhouette of him. Yeah, it says John Roderick seal of approval. So that was a great time, but it went till the wee hours of the morning. And then I had a shift on Saturday. It went quite long. So anyway, I have recovered. I also spent the afternoon at a gaming meetup playing the Star Trek Next Generation trading card game, which we talked about. So I finally have all the rules figured out. And I have decided it is actually a really fantastic game. It's well-balanced. It's very interesting. The card mechanics, once you get your head around what different cards allow you to do, it's very varied and does it allow you to try different strategies. So I'm super looking forward to playing more of it in the future. And I'm actually trying to figure out a way the two of us can play over the internet. I haven't figured it out yet. Give me a couple more weeks to work out the kinks.
That'll be cool. We'll have to tilt our web cameras down, or we could just call Sheldon because I am pretty sure those guys have some kind of setup.
Well, I just figured I'd put
that would work perfectly for playing.
Yeah, if we can get FaceTime working properly, which we're still having trouble, I can just put the iPhone on a little thing you can move around and have it just point the camera at your at the cards and make it work that way. I don't know. There's not too much that you've got to keep secret from me. So,
I have an idea. What we'll do is we'll wear hats that we get from Talosians, of course, and we'll mount our iPhones on the hats themselves.
Yes,
like the front of our head. So then, as we play, you'll just be seeing it's like point of view, right there. You can see the cards on my desk. I can see yours, and we'll be all set.
It's perfect. It's perfect.
So, well, that sounds interesting. Now, how many players have you found is the perfect number of players for playing this game?
I've actually only played with 4 players. It's supposed to go from 2 to 5. I've never quite found that fifth player, and I've never gotten just one person to play with me. I feel like if it were 2 players, the game would go really quickly, and that might even be a good thing. The game can take quite a long time when you have to wait on each person to figure out what they're doing. 4 players feels like it's a good amount, just because nobody gets too many of the main characters. You know, only one person can get Jean-Luc Picard, but maybe one person gets Jean-Luc, somebody gets Data, somebody gets Geordi, somebody gets Pulaski, and everyone but that person is very happy with the characters they have.
You know, speaking of Dr. Pulaski here, I've been under the weather now for about 5 days, and I don't know what my voice sounds like, everyone, if you're listening. If my voice sounds pretty bad, I apologize, try to push through here because I've been rather sick. But But about Pulaski, though, you know, what I think happened to me is that I was on an away mission. We were in the swamp and I was bitten by an insect, and I've been infected with some kind of microbe that mimics both a virus and a bacteria. And I was at the doctor today, and apparently I'm going to have to undergo some kind of treatment where I lay on a table and I have to relive all the past events of my life. So not really looking forward to that. And I don't know if that's what happens to you when you get the Pulaski card in this game, but I don't wish that on anyone.
Certainly not. Certainly not. The Shades of Grey card is not one of the best that you can come across.
Most definitely not. All right. Well, why don't we jump ahead to some various Star Trek news? And this week we have a collection of actually have quite a bit of music going on this time here at the start. Anyway, one of the big things going around the Twitter this past week, of course, has been the official video for William Shatner's cover of Bohemian Rhapsody, which we talked about his new album, Seeking Major Tom, last week on the show here. And Greg, have you had a chance to watch this rather bizarre and very, what I would say is perfectly shat video?
Perfectly shat. That's a, oh dear. We're going to lose our clean tag. As I was telling you before the show, I have not had any time to just sit in front of my computer all week. I was trying to watch our feature on my iPhone as I took the bus home this evening. But you did have me sit down and watch this video just now, and I must say, nothing could have prepared me for the chatness. It is exactly right. What I imagined, you know. Now, when I first heard of it, what it was going to be, as we discussed last week, these aren't songs I'm familiar with, and the way Shatner does them is unique, to use a word that is attributed to Shatner's music quite a long time. And
yeah,
it's perfect. You know, it's perfect for what it is. I think is what I'm trying to say. What was your reaction? Maybe being more familiar with the original and more familiar, you had heard the song before you saw the video. So what was your reaction?
Oh yeah, of course. Well, I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody, of course, is one of the most covered songs. Yes. In the history of music, I would say, you know, everybody has to do their version of Bohemian Rhapsody at some point in their lives, it seems.
Yeah, someone called out to...
Someone
called out to John at the Long Winter Show on Thursday, do Bohemian Rhapsody! And he just, you know, glared at them.
Yeah, right.
Like, shut up.
That's right. So, of course, I'm familiar with the original and many covers over the years, and I've been listening to this album before the video was released. I was already familiar with Shatner's version of it. And I wasn't prepared, I guess, for the video version of it. I guess they did what they should have done with it, because it's such a ridiculously over-the-top, overly dramatic performance that Shatner gives on the album. The video, one of my first thoughts seeing it was, it reminded me a little bit of the God scene from Star Trek V.
That was the exact where thought you've I got had, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot like that. It's really eerie. And then, you know, the typesetting of the words at the bottom of the screen, it's... The whole thing is very comical.
Yes.
It reminded me a little bit of Monty Python, especially in the latter half of the video when you start having singing fish and goats and... The constellations are coming to life,
typography actually reminded me of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie. I'm not sure if it was the same font.
That's
but
true.
I got it. Yeah, I did get a very Hitchhiker, Monty Python, that sort of British sci-fi comedy. That's the sort of vibe I got from it.
Yeah, that's what it was. I saw someone tweeted, I think it was yesterday, someone watched this video and they tweeted that this video is exactly what I always thought a drug trip would be like.
And someone who hasn't seen Star Trek IV, and the opening of that is they time travel. I'm pretty sure that's what I always thought a drug trip would be like. Maybe they're different drugs. That's the issue here.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole slingshot around the sun in Star Trek IV. Yeah, exactly. If you haven't seen the video, definitely go watch it. It's a sight to behold. One of the things I thought about it was that this video. So the album Seeking Major Tom is a pretty good album. It has some really good tracks on it, as I mentioned last week, and it has some not so great tracks on it. And it has some that are just really over the top, like this one. And so the fact that they picked this one as the first track to do a video for and release it to the public, which of course will go viral in a way that the album doesn't, I think it kind of reinforces the preconceived notions that people have about Shatner and music being put together and about this album. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's getting more attention for the album. At the same time, I think it may encourage a lot of people to kind of write off the album as being another ridiculous Shatner moment instead of giving it a shot. So it's kind of a mixed bag on what this does for Seeking Major Tom, but it's definitely entertaining. And we'll put a link to it in the show notes and everyone can go check it out and do the Fandango if you haven't yet seen it.
Oh, man. It was crazy. And I'm still avoiding listening to the actual album. I don't think I want to taint my fond memories of Has-Been. I don't know. It sounds like you've been quite enjoying it, though. So I do encourage our listeners to go out there and check it out for themselves and see what they think.
Yeah, I am enjoying it. There's some brilliant stuff on there, like the cover of She Blinded Me with Science is great. And then there's some just, you know, stuff like this one or Iron Man and all that are not so great. But at any rate, speaking of music, our friend of the show, Mike Rittenhouse, and his band Five Year Mission are getting really close now to releasing Year 2, which everyone's been waiting for. It's been, I guess, a couple of years since Year 1 came out.
When is it coming out, Chris? When is it coming out? Have they finished writing it yet? Is Zachary Quinto going to be in it? Is he working out?
I do hear that Zachary Quinto is prepping for Year 2. He is doing some eyebrow exercises for Year 2. And I also hear that he's coating the jellyfish craft with some Corbomite.
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
So, and he's chosen classic Starship Gray, I believe, for that.
Perfect.
I understand from Mike that they have finished the album and they're just doing some mastering right now and getting ready to send it off to be pressed and should be out early December. Mm-hmm. And it's available for pre-order right now on their website. And we're going to talk, kind of leading up to that, we're going to talk about some of the different tracks on it over the coming weeks here on the show. And the first video that they released, this is actually out on their site and on YouTube, and we've put it on Trek FM as well, is for Errand of Mercy. And I don't know if you had a chance to hear their take on Errand of Mercy yet. It's only been out a couple of days now.
So this was a case of, I did see that it came out, and I'm honestly trying to stay spoiler-free for Year 2, because I don't know, we can let the listeners in on a little secret that we're going to be getting here in the Trek FM offices a copy of Year 2 so that we can talk about it in the coming weeks. So my plan is to listen to the album in total and just listen to it as music first. So I've been avoiding this video. So maybe you can talk about the video and not give away too much of musically where Five Year Mission is going with Year 2. I'm quite excited to hear. Is it similar to their previous videos where it's just cut together versions of the episode? I have been enjoying those, especially ones like Corbomite Maneuver, where the song is very comical. I do like it, the sort of comical cut together video.
Yeah, it's the same kind of video that they've been doing in the past with clips from the show put together. And this one, I guess what you're saying you're going to do is you're going to get on the bus, you're going to go to work, and you're just going to sit there smiling as the armies move in, which is one of the lines from Errand of Mercy here. It's a fun song that largely tells the story of the episode Errand of Mercy from the point of view of the Organians, because we see a lot of the episode, we see it from Kirk and Spock's point of view and from the Klingons' point of view, more so than the Organians. So here they're kind of turning the table a bit, and the Organians are explaining how they're going to intervene and not to forget what we've done for you here today. So it's a fun song. And we have a link to the video on our website, and we will have other Five Year Mission things coming here and there on the site. So just check those out, and then we'll try to keep Greg spoiler free here for the moment. But I just wanted to mention that, and I'm very excited that year two is finally going to be here, because I've been listening to year one over and over and
yes,
over,
of course.
And definitely ready for some new Star Trek songs from Five Year Mission.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really looking forward to them getting into TNG, as I'm assuming they're going to. But I'm sort of, Dork Trek is doing TNG, and Five Year Mission is doing TOS, and they're both moving into year two over the next couple months. So both are going quite well, and I'm enjoying both quite a bit. I need to actually go back through Dork Trek and listen to season one again, and listen to year one a little bit as we're leading into year two. And actually, I think I need to watch season two of Star Trek, because it's probably the least, I've watched it the least for some reason. I keep watching season one over and over again, and there's a few episodes in season three that I keep watching, but season two, like Errand of Mercy, I can't even tell you too detailed my remembrances of it, even though I know I've seen it in the past couple years.
Yeah, I think Errand of Mercy still falls within the first season of the show, but it's on year two on the album, because
the way
they split it up, they didn't get all, there were like 20, gosh, how many were there? 27, I think, episodes of TOS, not counting the cage. In the first season, which of course never happens on television these days. There's so many of them. I was going to ask you what song, what episode that's going to be on year two are you most looking forward to hearing Five Year Mission's take on?
Well, the one I would be saying is Space Seed, of course. Although we actually do know what Space Seed sounds like, at least the acoustic version they did on our show just a few months
ago. That's right. Yeah.
But that would be the one, and I'm still very excited to hear the final version of it. So what would you say? What is your biggest one?
Oh, from year two is a good question. I'm curious to see what they do with the Squire of Gothos. And I think The Devil in the Dark could be interesting because, you know, Spock mind melds with Lava Rock, basically, in that episode. It could be fun. Of course, The City on the Edge of Forever. I'm interested in hearing what angle they take on that. You know, did they take the Kirk Edith Keeler romance angle, or do they take the drugged up McCoy angle, or, you know, where do they go with that? And of course, Operation Annihilate, because it's the only episode of the original series that has an exclamation point in the title.
Oh, really? Interesting.
So that implies excitement. Right off the bat, you know, I think the only other episode of Star Trek, of any Star Trek series, that has an exclamation point in the title is The Bride of Chaotica Voyager. It's just something you don't find very often, right?
Well, and then at the beginning of Star Wars Episode III is War!
War! That's
right. You gotta love that exclamation.
That's the one where that movie starts out with like a 10-page word-for-word copy of some kind of trade agreement, right?
Oh, that's episode one. It's all about trade agreements. No, episode three begins with a 10-minute sequence of space battles. It's like a one continuous shot. It's quite impressive.
Yeah, I remember that. That's pretty good. I just remember watching one of those prequel movies and thinking that, like, whatever happened to the here's what's going on and let's jump in, you know? It's like, we will not trade goods on Mondays or Wednesdays unless it is a half moon. Like, Lucas, get to the point. Okay, but
what
anyway,
is this?
This is our Star Trek
season
podcast.
One?
Not our. It's not our Star Wars podcast. So, the other reason I want to hear Operation Annihilate is because any episode that features gigantic leeches, space leeches that look like fried eggs, is something that has to be full of musical potential. And I cannot wait to see what goes on there either.
Yeah, very, very exciting.
All right, well, we will find out soon.
Yes.
Another thing that was going around this week that was a very interesting infographic from sortable.com. This was called Star Trek is Just Around the Corner. This actually, I think it goes back to maybe the beginning of the week, end of the week before. Mm-hmm. Very long infographic matching up Star Trek technologies with real-world progress on these technologies.
Right. Very interesting infographic. This is something I did get a chance to see this week. And it is something, of course, people have talked about for years and years, about how Star Trek influences technology. We talked last week about Siri and how everyone's comparing it to the computer from Star Trek. I even heard someone talking about Siri being a female voice and comparing that to the female voice of the computer and how we like subservient voices to be female, whereas we like commanding voices to be male. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I thought of all that, but it was interesting that here's another person making the comparison between what Siri is doing and what Star Trek has been doing for years and years.
Yeah, right. You know, I was just looking at something earlier today about Siri and the voice, and apparently in the UK, Siri has a male voice.
Yeah, it's
and has a female voice in the US. And for those who don't know, in the settings for Siri, you choose your language, which can be for English. There's US English, UK English, and Australian English. So it has a different voice based on, you know, what dialect you
select. Well, and don't forget the Soviet English, where you can ask Siri where the Soviet vessels are at.
That's right. And she will say, "I'm sorry, I cannot look up locations in Japan."
That's too bad.
Which seems to be a response I frequently get. But yeah, she will say, "I think they're in Alameda."
There we go.
"Let me pull that up for you. I found this for you."
Very good.
So the other thing I was seeing just before we started the show here, actually, I was looking at a post about why, from a scientific perspective, why do computers typically have female voices?
Right.
And it's basically, I guess, comes down to the fact that our brains seem to be designed to find female voices more appealing than male voices. And that's why, because it's not just computers. I mean, you know, from being in Japan, from living in Japan, almost all announcements on trains or in stores or in stations are female voices as
well. I have a confession to make that's related to this. I was, you know, I work in a call center, so I'm constantly just listening to voicemail systems. The one that I reached had, you know, press 1 for English, press 2 for Spanish, and it was press 3 for Japanese. And I clicked the third link, and I literally sat there for a good 60 seconds simply listening to, you know exactly what I'm talking about, that calm, very distinct female voice just reading a list of, you know, options. But it was so, it's something I just got really used to in Japan, of hearing this very calming voice, and it really actually made my day, crazily enough, hearing this.
Right.
So I totally understand
that's
that.
It's like your Natsukashi
moment
for the day, right?
So I might have to turn Siri on Japanese mode once they add that as well, just to hear it.
Yeah.
So I think we did read the same article,
yeah.
Actually. I think that's the same article I was talking about.
Oh, maybe. Well, did you see in the comments, someone made a very good suggestion, which I kind of agree with, was that we should just simply use James Earl Jones's voice for everything.
This is the subway you're looking for.
"I'm sorry, I cannot look up locations in Japan."
You seem to be having lots of trouble. I keep using it. You know, I couldn't imagine if it couldn't find me locations. I constantly ask Siri, you know, "How do I get home from here?" And she just plots me a course.
Yeah.
I can even say, "How do I get home here by bus?" If I couldn't do that with Siri, man, that would be rough.
Well, right now, there are a number of functions that don't work outside the U.S., and Maps is one of them. And I don't understand, because the Google Maps feature of iOS works here, but it doesn't work by you asking Siri to find your location. So it eventually will work when they, you know, add the language. Yeah. But anyway, why don't we jump back
this infographic so it doesn't that we're become talking
our Yeah. This is Mac Break Weekly.
Exactly.
And we're your host. And John Dvorak is over here basting meat on the side.
yeah.
Anyway, so this infographic, they start off with the communicator, which, of course, you know, ties into what we're talking about here with the iPhone, Siri, and all. And of course, they point out that there are 4.6 billion mobile phone subscribers out there. And that's a lot of communicators.
But can you use your mobile phone to communicate with a starship in orbit? I mean, that's really the question.
You can, as long as they also have FaceTime.
Are you saying the Enterprise D communicator screen on the bridge is just a big FaceTime screen?
Yeah, it is. You never notice there's that like little dot at the top of the screen right in the center where the camera
that explains
is.
Explains it.
You never
notice. And then
they
have iMessage on their little hand rests.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, even though they have that, Picard prefers to just tweet you commands, like ram the ship.
Hashtag engage.
That's how they would communicate with us. Yeah, that's right. Make it so. So obviously, you know, communicators are there. Tricorders, they get into tricorders and they give it a 3-star. They're doing these out of 5 stars. So communicators, 5 stars. Mm-hmm. It's reality. We have this technology. Tricorders, 3 stars.
Okay.
There are some instruments that are very similar. You know, there's this XPRIZE, if you remember the XPRIZE for spaceships, which was quite successful in kind of launching the civilian private space industry. They're doing that now for a tricorder as well. I think we talked about maybe on one of our very first shows here. So that's on the way. They also cover replicators, phasers, hypospray, cloaking devices, the visor, Geordi's visor, warp drive pad, which of course we have as iPads and Android
Certainly.
Tablets, big screen, and the universal translator. What do you think of these would be the one... Okay, except warp drive. Huh. I mean, obviously, we're not anywhere near warp drive. Excluding warp drive, what do you think is the technology that we're the least close to that you would think we might be able to build?
Well, I think the one I would think would be next on the horizon would be the phaser. We've been using projectile weapons for a long time, and it's about time we figured out a better way to shoot people. There, we have a show title. I just feel like we keep figuring out keep figuring out like lasers and things like that. Surely we can put this into a gun that we can change the settings. And I mean, they have like stun guns, but that requires, it sort of shoots out, tags that stick into a person and then shocks them from a distance. And I've seen things where they were able to shoot a short burst of laser and create heat on the subject. So that's getting close to it. I don't know what sort of breakthrough is needed to get to the phasers. But it seems like it should be possible. And it's something that would be very useful, that, you know, you're not going to run out of ammo as long as you have enough energy. And you can obviously dial it up or down depending on what you need to do. Not that I think we should have disruptors and should be able to just shoot at something and make it disintegrate like on Star Trek 6 or 2, but just the ability to hit somebody with something that is going to stop them but not create bodily harm.
Right.
Seems like it's important for the advancement of our civilization.
Yeah, I would agree. And obviously the military wants to have this technology, and if the military wants to have it, then resources will go into development of it. You know, the problem with so many of these technologies is that some of them have primarily military applications and some of them have more civilian applications, and the research funding is always going to go towards the military. Sadly, that's the world we live in. So phasers would be one that definitely money will be poured into. Another one that money would be poured into is cloaking. And for me, of these things, the two are probably the phaser and the cloaking device are two technologies that I think we can develop in a relatively short term. And they give both of these two stars.
Mm-hmm.
Phasers, what they say where we are in terms of phasers, and they say the U.S. military has tested non-lethal laser rifles, which are designed to incapacitate an enemy without killing them, either by temporarily blinding them or stunning them. And as Scotty tells you, the best diplomat is a fully loaded phaser bank. So The research is ongoing. I guess to get phasers like you see being fired by the Enterprise against a bird of prey, for example, or something, there's a huge problem of energy there,
right?
And focusing the energy that has to be overcome. But it's definitely something that I think will come in time. I don't see anything impossible about it. It's just will take some time. The cloaking is interesting because there's been, I don't know how much play it's gotten in the U.S., but there's been quite a bit of work done here in Japan over the past few years in cloaking technology. Mm-hmm. And they've actually developed a cloak that's very much like Harry Potter's cloak, which is something that you can wear. Mm-hmm. The word cloak,
right?
I think sometimes Star Trek fans forget is the name of an article of clothing.
Yes.
Because I've had people get upset at me when I mention Harry Potter because they say cloaks are Star Trek. Harry Potter came up with that much later on. Well, no, you wear a cloak.
Yes.
A cloak conceals you.
A cloak,
you
know, is
that's
a thing.
That's what the word cloak means. So when you're cloaking something, you're concealing it. But and it's actually, I saw a video of this. They just went out into a park in Tokyo and they had someone wear this cloak. And you could see right through the person, and
you could
see the people walking in the park behind him. And I mean, it wasn't perfect, and he wasn't totally invisible. But to be at that point now, you have to imagine that 20, 30 years from now, cloaking an airplane, cloaking a ship, something like that, is probably quite feasible. You know, we already can hide things from radar with stealth technology. Mm-hmm. So now we're just talking about hiding them from your sight by manipulating light. It's a technology that's definitely on the way. They give it 2 stars, but I think it's
closer.
Definitely
closer
on the way.
Than 2 stars.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I would probably give it 3 right now.
Yeah.
Definitely on the way though. So we'll put a link to this infographic if anyone wants to go look at it. It's a really large file. It was done by sortable.com. We have a post for it on Trek FM, and then we have a link there to the full-size graphic that you can open in a separate window because it's like, it's huge. It's like a 5 megabyte image or something like that,
big.
The full-size thing. So I didn't want to just stick the whole thing on the page. All right. Well, that was a good one. And while we talk about technologies, this came out earlier this week that Microsoft, of all people, has taken a step towards holodeck technology.
Yeah, this is interesting.
And
very interesting.
I don't know if have you seen the demonstration of this yet? They just put up a couple of days ago, it doesn't even have any audio. It's just a video demonstration, no sound, of them using this system that they are developing called Holodesk.
Yeah, I haven't seen the demonstration. I read the article that you posted about it, and it's, you know, going back to the Star Trek technical manual, the TNG technical manual, where it sort of explained how the holodeck worked. It, you know, seemed like something kind of imminently doable. It just kind of had to get to that point. And we've had virtual reality technology where you know put a thing on your head and some things on your hands and you can move around in an environment. And it sort of seemed like, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or so, the technology stopped as far as what consumers could use. But it seemed like in the background, there was a lot of things advancing to get us to the point that Microsoft is at right now.
Yeah, it did seem like that. I think when the next generation first came out, of course, the idea of a holodeck seemed very far-fetched. And as technology has advanced, and as you know, televisions have gotten better, and now we have things like the 3DS, where you don't even need glasses to see three-dimensional images, which actually works quite well. If you haven't tried a 3DS, I was very skeptical of it when they announced it. And my son has one, and so I have played with it a little bit, and was very surprised at how well it works. Of course, you have to be looking right at it. You can't look at it from the side. It doesn't work well that way. But it's like an early step. And then when you see what they're doing, what Microsoft is doing with this holodesk, it's, again, it's very rudimentary. It's a very crude way of doing it. But there are, besides what it looks like to you visually, there are some technologies behind it that they demonstrate in this video that really make you believe that certainly within the time frame of Star Trek, where we're talking right. about 300 years from now, you can certainly believe that something like the holodeck would really exist in a room like that. And it might even be much, much sooner than that. Like within this century, we might have some technology like that.
Yeah, definitely. Like on Enterprise, they definitely showed that the holodeck was not in use at that point. I guess that was the
except for the series finale, right?
Well, once again, just like the third season of TOS and the second season of Next Gen, I don't consider those canon. So let's not speak of it. But there was the episode where Tucker goes on the alien ship and A is impregnated right. and B visits a holodeck and he comes back and sort of tells everyone, sort of like when Picard goes on the holodeck in the first season and tells everyone, "It's amazing, there were automobiles." Tucker comes back and is telling people how amazing it was and how it felt like he was really there. And I think in our, you know, the real universe that we actually live in, we might have this holodeck much sooner than that. You know, they always say 5 to 10 years for AI getting really to the level of being able to talk to it. They've been saying 5 to 10 years since the 70s.
Yeah, they've been saying that for 20 years, so, yeah, 20, 30 years.
But I still think, you know, maybe not 5 to 10, maybe 15 to 20 years, and we're going to really have virtual environments that we can interact with in a way that feels like reality. It really wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, me neither. It really seems it's headed that way. I was just thinking, as you were saying Picard on the holodeck, that Barclay comes out of the holodeck and he's like, "It was amazing. There were women there who talked to me." And then Geordi says, "Me too."
That's kind of me anyway. After I got back from Japan. "There are girls who speak English." Wow.
Yeah, right. Wow, they exist. No. But this setup... we'll put a link to the video. People can go watch the video and see what it's like. What I found, well, first, the setup right now is there is a pretty large little, I mean, it's like a box, basically, right. A pretty large box. At the top, there's a screen, and then at the bottom, there's what's called a beam splitter, and then there's a web camera in the middle and looking out at the user. And so this ties into the Kinect technology, which they're already deploying in the Xbox area. The Kinect, and the camera does a face tracking so that it knows where the user is looking. And then there are two things which they describe as a flow field and particle tracking that go on that kind of trace the contour of your hands and trace the movement of your hands so that your hands can actually operate within this three-dimensional holographic environment to manipulate objects. And they show one demonstration of someone just, you know, picking up a ball, a holographic ball, and tossing it around as if it's real. They show a demonstration of people stacking blocks. So they have this tall tower of blocks that looks completely three-dimensional. And of course, they're not really there. They're holograms. And, you know, they put a ball on the target on top of the blocks, and the ball rolls off. Blocks can come down. And they call it like a physics playground for research, which I think will probably be one of the early applications of this kind of technology before it actually makes its way into any kind of consumer products. And then they also demonstrate using it for prototyping projects, which was really cool. They were showing how, like, if you want to develop a smartphone, you can use this holographic environment to quickly prototype a phone that feels real, that you can hold, that you can operate and demonstrate, even though it doesn't even exist.
Right, again, which is something they definitely did in Star Trek. I mean, when they went to design the Delta Flyer. I mean, not only did they design it in the holodeck.
Ah, good point.
They did field tests. Like, they took it into virtual space.
Yes.
Before they put any actual metal together in real life.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. And, of course, we can kind of do that now by, you know, running the numbers on something, you know, running tests and find out how it would react. But it's not the same as being able to actually build what seems to be real. Yeah. Like they did, like you said, with the Delta Flyer. It's a very, very good example from Star Trek of that. So I'm really excited to see where this heads over the next few years. And I'm also really, I'm glad to see Microsoft working on something that, for, I mean, I guess I shouldn't say that. I mean, I know they work on things like flat panel. Like, I think they've worked on roll-up flat panel displays, which would eventually be used for, like, the control panels that we see on the Enterprise. But it's interesting to see them doing these things behind the scenes that have these great future applications, when what we normally hear about them in the news is just Windows Phone, Xbox kind of thing. Yeah. But actually, there's this kind of Star Trek technology going on as well. Yeah. Very cool stuff.
Very cool, very cool.
So, Greg, Halloween is right around the corner, and by the time our next show comes out, Halloween will either be here or have passed. It's next Monday, the 31st. And getting into the Halloween spirit, one thing that I do every year is actually read Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. Oh, nice. It's one of my favorite poems, and I know it's not exactly a Halloween story, but it has that spooky feel to it that just goes so well with the holiday season. And last year, Quantum Mechanics, who you know make these things like the $5,000 Enterprise replica that's out right now, and which is beautiful. I mean, it's a gorgeous thing. It's very expensive, but they make all kinds of great props for Battlestar Galactica and Star Trek and other science fiction properties. Last year, around Halloween, they released this video of The Raven being read by John DeLancey, and I pulled it out again and posted it to Trek FM for this season, just because it's such a brilliant reading. Have you had a chance to, have you heard this before?
I believe I did see it last year. I've not had a chance to go back, read it now, but John DeLancey has one of those wonderful voices, and I wish he did more voiceover work just in general, because every time he sits down and does something like this, I mean, it's sort of like Shatner, but it's even more like someone like Mark Hamill, where he just gets his voice around a character or a sound he's trying to make, and really exudes it. And it doesn't just sound like Q reading Edgar Allan Poe. It really sounds like he's just bringing it to life.
Yes. Yeah, very much. And why don't we play just a little clip of this?
Presently my soul grew stronger. Hesitating then no longer, "Sir," I said, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here I open wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more."
So it's just amazing reading that he does on this. And, you know, I've met John DeLancey at a con many, many years ago. It was like, gosh, in the 90s, sometime mid-90s maybe. And one thing I found interesting, because of the way that he played the role of Q and the way he reads The Raven here, he said that he has the most terrible time remembering lines.
Really?
And yeah, and I found it amazing, because you don't get that impression at all when you watch him. But he said it's just like the hardest thing for him is memorizing the lines. When he was on Star Trek, especially.
That's really interesting. I hadn't actually heard that before.
You wouldn't expect that.
No.
And I think, and it's not just a technobabble thing. It's like actually just memorizing lines, as I remember him saying.
I thought he would have been a stage actor, like the rest of the Star Trek actors. I do wonder what his background is now.
Yeah, you know, I should know that, and I actually don't. If he didn't rise up through the ranks of performing arts as a stage actor, I would be surprised, because he definitely has the brilliance for
that. Well, maybe he only played characters who were constantly holding papers in front of them and reading off of them.
Yeah. All right. So we'll put a link to this on the site, and I really encourage everybody to go and watch this at least once a day between now and Halloween, because it's really probably the most brilliant reading of The Raven that I've ever seen. And that includes the Simpsons Halloween special.
That's great. That's great.
All right. Okay. So on a serious side here, one other bit of news that came out this week, Greg, was a gift from the Roddenberry Foundation to the Gladstone Institutes, who are doing stem cell research. And the Roddenberry Foundation, I think, is one of the great legacies of Gene Roddenberry and Star Trek itself, that through through the fan. I mean, all the support the fans have given to Star Trek over the years, which have made Star Trek so huge, you know, has allowed Rod Roddenberry, Gene's son, and Majel Barrett to found the Roddenberry Foundation and be able to give money as philanthropists to groups that can further scientific research and the ideals of Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah, this is one of those things I really love to see. Obviously, Roddenberry's legacy has lived on after he passed, and Star Trek became bigger and bigger. But it's important to remind people that, you know, he was more than just making TV shows. And I don't know if stem cells were even something people thought of at the time he was alive. Certainly, it is something today that is in great need of funding, because it's where science is going. It's where research needs to be done to make some of the big advancements that are going to happen in the next 10 to 15 years that are really going to revolutionize where we're at. So to see the Roddenberry Foundation supporting this is a huge boost to something that's been a controversy for not a good reason, but it's been controversial. And to see some big mainstream backing of the research is really fantastic.
Oh, most definitely. And I think if Gene Roddenberry were alive today, he would be very proud of this gift. I mean, this is a $5 million gift to the Gladstone Institute. So it's a very significant bit of money. And, you know, with that money, and they can continue stem cell research. And I know some people are opposed to it and some people are in favor of it. But either way, you know, the potential of stem cells to cure a wide range of diseases that afflict the human race right now, some of which we have no cures mm-hmm. for, is really amazing. And like Alzheimer's alone, I believe the numbers are there are around 5.4 million patients, or Alzheimer patients in the U.S., And it costs $183 billion to the U.S. and to Americans and everyone involved in treatment, healthcare, and losses here and there for that. And I mean, that's an absolutely enormous amount of money. And, you know, just gifts like this $5 million here, the amount of good that can be done by that through research can cure so many people and reduce those expenses as well for the country, and it furthers the ideals of Star Trek and gets closer to that Star Trek future where they're able to treat these types of diseases. You know, like Dr. McCoy mm-hmm. in your favorite movie, The Voyage Home, when he's in the hospital and the woman tells him that she's on dialysis. And he's like, dialysis? What is this? The Dark Ages? And
right,
just take this and call me in the morning, basically, right? You know, we have a long way to go on that yeah. stuff, but I just think it's wonderful that Star Trek, and in a way, this is something that is coming from all Trekkies, all fans of Star mm-hmm. Trek, because it's our support of Star Trek that ultimately has enabled Rod Roddenberry and Roddenberry Foundation to be able to give this money. So just a wonderful thing, a wonderful example of the good that Star Trek does for the world.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, everything from what we talked about earlier with Star Trek influencing science to something like this, where it's the money that fans put into Star Trek going towards philanthropic efforts like this. It really shows how well-rounded Roddenberry's family is, and how Star Trek fans are encouraging them to do this sort of thing. It's great. So similar to the Child's Play charity that gamers do. I'd love to see even more stuff like this coming from the Star Trek community. So hopefully we will see that in years to come.
We'll be right back.
From the very beginning, Star Trek Deep Space Nine promised to be a different kind of Star Trek, yet the first few seasons had more in common with The Next Generation in terms of storytelling. But starting with the fourth season and the episode Way of the Warrior, DS9 came into its own. And today we're going to talk about The Way of the Warrior. So Greg, The Way of the Warrior, I've always kind of thought of it as kind of a reset button for Deep Space Nine. I guess first of all, your experience coming across The Way of the Warrior, was it by watching Deep Space Nine on DVD or in reruns from the beginning forward?
Right. So that's my interesting experience with DS9, whereas TNG is kind of fractured, and I'm only now seeing it from the start all the way through in order. DS9 I've only experienced in order, and I've gone back and watched a few episodes here or there, but my first ever experience was in getting the story bit by bit. And so I'd seen things like Sisko's shaved head. I'd seen it in promotional stuff, but you know, going through the first three seasons, you know, that's just sort of what Sisko looked like for me. So when the season started and wow, you know, suddenly Sisko has this brand new look, you know, it really hit me on a level that, and also because I had been watching it so quickly and I hadn't, you know, spending all summer, maybe when the show first aired, hearing that they were making changes, you know, this was just the next episode for me. I didn't know that there were big changes like this coming to the show.
Yeah, it was something. See, my memories of it were, this was in 1995, I believe, when this episode came out. It was October 2nd, 1995 was the original air date of this episode. And back then, you know, the internet was pretty young back then from, you know, what we know of the internet today. And I've been online since the 80s, actually, for different, you know, systems. And back at that time, I was a CompuServe user. And that was also at the point when Microsoft Network and Paramount had joined together to put the official Star Trek website as part of MSN.
Ah, right. I remember that, actually.
It was called Star Trek Continuum, and you could only access it if you were a member of MSN. So I was a CompuServe user, but I had an MSN account just so I could access Star Trek Continuum. Which annoyed the hell out of me, but that's how it was, you know, it's what you had to do. So, but what I remember on those two services, CompuServe and MSN, I remember spending the whole summer in 1995 debating Deep Space Nine with other Star Trek fans, and especially the rumor that Worf was going to be joining the cast. And perhaps like an iPhone pundit of today who can never guess what Apple's going to do and denies what they're going to do. My position at the time was that Worf would not become a regular cast member on Deep Space Nine because I didn't think that Michael Dorn wanted to commit to what would it be, 4 more years of wearing that makeup every day, you know, after having been on The Next Generation since 87. So
yeah, I'm trying to remember. It was... He played Worf from obviously 87 until the show ended in 93 or 4?
99.
Well, until...
The show ended in 99. Oh, you mean The Next Generation.
The Next Generation.
Next Generation ended in 94.
If I remember correctly. And then he went right into Generations.
And Generations was later.
And then he played Worf continuously on DS9 from 95 to 99. So he played the same character pretty much every week.
Played Worf. Then he played Worf all the way through to Nemesis.
Right. So it's just, I mean, but even the rest of the TNG cast, I mean, other than O'Brien, you know, but he wasn't really in the show early on. He really committed to Worf in a way that no other Star Trek actor really committed to their character for such a extensive amount of time, extensive amount of work.
Yeah, absolutely. He's kind of like the Frasier of space.
It is similar to a show like that, but then this is, you know, sci-fi. Usually actors are eager to get out. You know, they sort of try to make their name with a show like this, and then they're eager to break the mold and show people that they can play a different character.
Right.
So I definitely see where you're coming from. I knew Worf was on DS9. I didn't actually realize when I went back and watched it, and I knew that it started simultaneous with Next Gen, but I was a little fuzzy on like when Worf was going to arrive. So he really showed up in this episode, and it completely surprised me. Like, I knew it was a Klingon episode. They were talking about, like, you know, we really need somebody who can talk to the Klingons. And then, whoa, Worf is here. Oh, I guess this is when he joins the cast.
And this is always interesting to me when I talk to fans who did not see these series in first run, because, you know, for me, I'm watching Deep Space Nine every week. Well, this is what happened in Tuscaloosa, okay, because Deep Space Nine was syndicated, and Tuscaloosa is a college town, you know, of about 50,000 people when school is in session, and about 15,000 people when it's not. So it's like a small television station there that's syndicating this. So I was watching Deep Space Nine all the way up until the episode Fascination, which I believe is a season three episode. And then I just kept watching Fascination over and over because the local channel kept showing that episode every time. They showed it 3 weeks in a row. And they never went back and showed the missing episodes.
Oh, man. Wow.
I mean, people were mad. It's like every week there's Jake holding this necklace up or something. So anyway, it's always interesting, though, these experiences, because, again, for me, there was no Worf on Deep Space Nine, and, you know, Sisko had hair and things. And then there was this summer-long debate about it. And my position was not only that I didn't think he would join the show, I thought he shouldn't join the show either, because I thought I wanted Deep Space Nine to stand on its own. And I didn't mind having O'Brien on there and Keiko, because they had been kind of like background characters on Next Generation, so it was fine, you know, that now they are in a more prominent role. But Worf was such a key to the Next Generation. I was afraid that having him on Deep Space Nine was going to take something away from the show. But I was wrong, because I think the addition to Worf was very critical for what Deep Space Nine turned out to be. Partially because, you know, his introduction came as part of a stronger Klingon presence on the show. And also he gave, you know, he's a character for whom you can write very interesting storylines. And he's a warrior. And in a show that ended up being so much about a war, being able to play off his character, I think, was very important for Deep Space Nine. So it really enriched the show, and I'm glad he came on. But it was such a surprise, and the debate. I mean, it was amazing, the debates that we had that summer.
Yeah, there was an interesting conversation on Dork Trek a few weeks ago at this point about who's the main character of Star Trek, of Next Gen, like, at least, like, what's the hierarchy?
Yeah, I heard that.
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah. So they sort of, I don't know, I can sort of move on from what they were talking about, where sort of the movies were definitely about Picard and Data. And the show was, to some extent, about Picard and Riker, and to some extent, Data. And, I mean, there were there were Worf episodes here or there, but the nature of the show, even as an ensemble, the nature of the show still led to, they kept going back to Picard and Riker and Data. And Worf never really got his due. And what's interesting about DS9 is, even though they had more characters than Next Gen ever had, they gave each of them so much more to do. You know, even someone like Garak had so much more of an arc than anybody on Next Gen, other than, you know, like the main three or four people.
Well, Garak does more in four episodes than Dr. Crusher did in the entire seven seasons of Star Trek and the Next Generation. I mean, it's so true. I mean, Deep Space Nine, the cast of Deep Space Nine, it's like 20 or 25 characters, and they use them all, and you know them all, and you feel connected to all these characters. And then you have the Next Generation, where Troy and Crusher and Geordi get almost no storylines.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's definitely a different thing. Let me ask you, I have a trivia question for you here.
Oh, dear.
Because bringing this up, that's a good point. And like what they were saying on Dork Trek and what you're saying here about Worf, because the Next Generation, it did have a lot of Klingon stories, but I feel that Deep Space Nine is the series that developed the Klingons. Again, I mean, The Next Generation developed the framework of their culture, and Deep Space Nine developed the heart of who they are and how they see the world, more so, I think. So my trivia question, though, is can you tell me which Star Trek series has the fewest appearances of the Klingons?
Well, are we trying to think? Are we counting B'Elanna Torres as the Klingons?
No.
Okay.
No, not main characters. Just Klingon episodes, Klingons showing up in episodes.
Well, surely it would be Voyager then.
No, it's not.
Really?
In fact, Voyager is number 3 out of 5.
Oh, wow. So would it be...
So what's your second guess?
It's got to be the original series then.
Yeah, it is. It's the original series.
Which you think they were a big... They were so big in the movies. Like, they were in every movie. And they were even in a couple TOS movies that never even got made. That's how much they were in the original series movies. But the show itself, now that you mention it, they did. They did so much of things that weren't villain. They weren't recurring villains. They kept doing new stories that even though you feel like the Klingons were there a lot, it may have not been that much.
No, they in fact the Klingons only appeared in 7 episodes of the original series, and one of those 7 is the Savage Curtain, where there is a replica of Kalis that was created by the Excalibians. So really, that's not a Klingon episode either.
Right.
The reason I asked you the trivia question here, because we're talking about, you know, Worf coming on DS9 and how we're going to talk, I want to talk more about how the Klingons become more part of DS9, is that, you know, fans get really upset about the Klingons looking different in the modern Star Trek series than they did in the original series. And the Klingons are kind of one of the best known aliens in Star Trek. I mean, maybe the best known outside of Vulcans because of Spock. And yet they appear so infrequently in the original series. It's amazing that they... I think it's like you said, because of the movies. They were utilized so much in the original series movies that people associate them. But okay, so... The first couple of seasons of DS9, kind of building up to this, were... We talked on a past episode of this show about the birth of Deep Space Nine and how it came about and how the pilot episode Emissary really set the stage for this different kind of Star Trek, darker Star Trek. But then, would you agree that the first couple of seasons of DS9 are not really indicative of the series?
It's definitely true. There's obviously we talked about... which episode was it now? Well, it wasn't even the episode, but we were talking about a season 3 episode of TNG, and here we have Riker with the beard and how we grew the beard, and that was an important thing. We sort of have the same thing here where we have the shaving the head, where
exactly what I was going to say.
All right.
Yeah. We shaved the head. DS9, TNG grew the beard, DS9 shaved the head.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. They did, that's what happened.
They did sort of self-contained storylines. They did very, very typical Star Trek things. And, you know, they did what you'd expect them to do. It was an outpost show. It was sort of about the Old West. So they did some very typical Western storylines that really hadn't been seen. You know, like a murder mystery. I can't bring back exactly some of the plot lines from the early season of TNG, but it was very much stuff we'd seen before, but let's do it in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Or it was on TNG, but let's do it a little darker. Let's do it with some characters who aren't in Starfleet and see how they react to it. There's nothing wrong with that, but it wasn't what it became, which was this very deep, engrossing storyline about these characters. It's not just, how the characters react to a storyline. It's what's going to happen because these characters are who they are and they do things that are going to surprise us.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the beginning of Next Generation, I mean, you have episodes like Babel or Move Along Home, things like that. And even the storyteller, where Miles is viewed by Bajorans down on the planet as kind of like a spiritual leader. He's a storyteller. You know, they were a little bit different than what we saw in The Next Generation, but you could also easily see that as a Next Generation story.
Right.
I think. So it was very much like that. And then as we got into season two, we got a little bit more development going on, but you know, you still had a lot of stories like Shadowplay or Armageddon Game or Playing God, these types of stories, which were still kind of in the TNG mold. We were kind of getting filled in a bit on the background of the Bajorans. We were getting a little bit more into the Bajoran religion. We were starting to find out a bit about the origins of Odo and about the founders and the Dominion that were kind of setting up what was going to come through season two. And then, you know, season two ended with the Jem'Hadar.
Mm-hmm.
And then in season three, we keep making that move more towards what we come to know as DS9, but it's still, we're kind of getting there. And then that season ends with the Adversary, and we go into the summer, and that's when they shave the head.
Right.
Right. That's when DS9 just changes direction and becomes this engrossing, very deep, very rich world in which you have the conflict that I think was promised at the beginning of the series that didn't quite happen over the first few seasons.
Right, right.
And this better, more deeper exploration of issues in humanity and so forth that you want to see from Star Trek.
Right. And this episode also gave us kind of the promise of the Klingons being back.
Yes.
Like they'd sort of been, ever since the start of Next Gen, you know, Gene put them into a peace treaty with the Federation. He put a Klingon on the bridge. He had that Klingon not do much. Certainly he didn't get into arguments with anybody. The closest he got was a few times, you know, he let his warrior out. He let his animal instincts out. But for the most part, he was just a good Starfleet officer. And this episode sort of gave us the promise of, wow, the Klingons are going to just start messing with stuff. They're going to just attack. They're going to complain. They're going to lie and cheat and steal and shoot things and stab people. And that's really exciting because that gets Star Trek back to where it really, I don't know if that's where it needed to be, but sort of where you felt like this show could really excel. You know, not doing just little story of the week things, but really let's shake up the Star Trek universe in a way that kind of the writers had been afraid to for so long.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, and like you say, make it exciting. I mean, this episode, The Way of the Warrior, is exciting from the moment it starts. I mean, it starts with them, with Sisko and Kira running around the station looking for a changeling. And of course, you don't know if it's a real changeling on the station yet or what, or the fact that it turns out to be a drill. But, you know, it's exciting from the very beginning. And then you have these, you know, because the Klingons are the big baddies now in here. You know, there was the peace treaty going back to Errand of Mercy in the first season of TOS, the Organian peace treaty. But the Klingons and, you know, in the Federation, they still didn't quite like each other. They didn't really get along all the way up through the movies, all the way up through Star Trek VI. And then we get the Khitomer Accords, which replaced the Organian peace treaty.
Right.
And then the Khitomer Accords, of course, then with Star Trek VI, we have no more TOS timeline until, you know, a little bit in Generations, but we jump all the way ahead to TNG.
Right.
And then, yeah, at that point, the Khitomer Accords seem to be well in place, and the Klingon and the Federations are all cozy together. And so here, you know, we are able to return the Klingons to this position of being warriors and being kind of a adversary to the Federation, and the space battles, because, you know, the technology was finally getting to the point where they could do this on television a bit. Although I have to think they must have just blown through massive budget on this.
Oh, no kidding, no kidding.
It's amazing. But, and like the Batleth fights in Ops and on the Promenade.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's really great episode. In some ways, it does remind me of The Best of Both Worlds what the best of both worlds did for the next generation.
Yeah, definitely.
This episode does for Deep Space Nine.
Well, I feel like part of it is Next Gen ended. So sort of like you talked about with last week with Larry, how the focus of everyone was on Next Gen. So even when DS9 was on the air, every Star Trek fan is going to be watching Next Gen. And a smaller portion are going to be watching Deep Space Nine. But once Next Gen sort of ends and they do the movie, and then now they're looking for ways to bring people from Next Gen to just start watching DS9. I got to imagine that was on their minds. It's part of why they brought on Worf. That's why they gave them so much money. That's why they started this war with the Klingons. They're thinking, what can we do to really get people in here and watching? And doing what we've been doing isn't going to work.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. That had to be on their mind, and no doubt a reason they brought in Worf. At the same time, they kind of shot themselves in the foot a bit there by launching Voyager immediately because, you know, DS9 had no time to itself.
Yeah.
I guess DS9, it had a few months where it was on TV. Like, the way The Warrior was on... Well, this was in 95, though, so it was actually going back to the season 3 where with The Search when they actually get the Defiant.
Right. I mean,
which was another effort to kind of breathe life into the series by giving them a way to get off the station.
Right. I mean, this was definitely after Next Gen ended, and there was that break where DS9 sort of had, I don't know, 3 months before Voyager came around. But I still feel
something like that.
This episode was them going back to the drawing board to a certain extent. Not relaunching the show, but in the same way that sort of when they came back to season 2 of Next Gen, you'd realize they'd made a lot of changes. They'd gotten more budget. They'd built more sets. They'd made some cast changes. This feels like they went back and said, you know what? We need to shake things up. We need to make things better. And there wasn't quite that shift, I felt, going into season 3. Although there's a little bit here and there. And there was the Defiant. But this feels like there's two epochs of DS9, where there was 1 to 3 and then 4 to 7.
Yeah, it is. It's true. That's how the series breaks down. Also here, they also got more money, and they also bought a bass because, you know, they got that bass line going in the theme music, which I found interesting. I always loved, I think DS9 has probably the best theme of any of the Star Trek series.
Interesting.
I'm sure that many people will disagree with me on that. I think it has a very beautiful theme that captures the whole concept of that show very well. But, you know, it was very slow for the first 3 seasons, and then they brought in the bass line, and they brought in Worf, and they brought in the battles,
right.
And they brought in the conflict more, and they brought in the bass line.
Right.
And it's interesting that they did the same thing, you know, Enterprise season 3. Again, it's like, well, the ratings aren't great, so why don't we pep up the theme song?
Which they ruined the Enterprise theme song. I mean, I know...
Yeah, the Enterprise theme song was much better without the...
I know people don't love Faith of the Heart. I know people don't. I really, really like it, but I cannot listen to that horrible season 3, season 4 version. The one thing I want Manny Coto to say about season 5 is that they were going to just bring back the original theme song. You know, that would make me really disappointed that Paramount canceled it.
That was their plan, I'm sure, to bring back the things. That's what he said, right? It came out of his magic bag of hindsight, right? I also prefer the Enterprise theme without the peppiness, the like rock ballad thing going on. And here I actually like DS9's theme with both. What I find interesting about the peppier version of the DS9 theme is that, you know, you have a show where everything's not nice and neat. Everything is kind of rough. And the bass line that they added in there doesn't quite mesh with the melody.
Right.
If you listen to it, if you try to count out the beats, it doesn't quite feel right. Which would normally bother me a bit, but it actually kind of works in this case because it's kind of like the whole show, the whole war with the Dominion. You know, everything's just not quite right in the Federation in DS9. And so it works. But at any rate, so we get Worf in on this episode and we get the Klingons in and we're introduced to so many more characters that become a part. I like when they inform Sisko that a Klingon ship has just decloaked and there is a General Martok who would like to speak to you, you know, and Martok becomes such an integral part of Deep Space Nine over the coming seasons, as does Gowron, and you know, Garrick's role in here is also amazing.
I don't think Cassidy wasn't introduced in this episode.
I don't think so, but this is definitely early on in their relationship.
Right. I think she showed up first on Family Business, but this was sort of the which was just at the end of season three. But this is the first. This is the start of her being an extremely integral part of the cast when she started showing up. Not every week, but enough that she really became very important to Sisko and then to us.
Yeah, I noticed it's like in here, in The Way of the Warrior, you know, Captain Sisko is there just, you know, he's going to go have a makeout session before he gets on the Defiant to go rescue Gul Dukat. And then, you know, you've got seven seasons of Picard and Dr. Crusher doing this little dance where they never, ever, you know, act on anything. And Sisko's got this giant grin.
Yeah.
And, you know, they basically have to pull him on the Defiant, you know, like, Captain, get a room. But, you know, and then they go off. So, other things in this episode that I think that define Deep Space Nine as a series and really set it on its new direction are, you know, cases like when they're on their way to rescue Gul Dukat and they find all these Cardassian ships that have been attacked by the Klingons and they think there may be survivors, but in a very uncharacteristic move for Federation officers, they don't stop to help because, you know, they would have to decloak that they, you have to think there's a cloaked Klingon ship nearby in that situation. And Sisko makes the decision to leave any survivors behind and continue on with the mission because it's for the greater good.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, defined. It wasn't the first time that something happened that defined who Sisko was as a character and what kind of captain and leader he was and how he differed from Picard, for example. But it's a really good example in that episode that we see time and again as the series goes on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just stuff like when he does go to rescue Cassidy and he is just so gruff and demanding of the Klingon commander that he gets him to step down. You know, and it reminds me of that joke that I've told here a million times about how, you know, I don't even know why Worf tries to open doors. Data's going to do it. Anyway, Picard...
Oh, I thought you were going to tell the one about the Ferengi and the gorilla suit.
Oh, no, that one. I have to save that one for the After Dark. But no, Picard, I don't think Picard could have gotten them to stand down. You know, that's not what Picard does. Sisko...
No, he would not.
Sisko can stand up to a Klingon. I mean, sure, he needed Worf there. Worf made a huge difference. But the way he was able to stand up to that Klingon commander and tell him, this is the way it's going to be, was really astonishing.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. I don't think Picard would have been able to handle that situation.
Yeah.
Maybe he would have to go activate the self-destruct. I don't know. But...
The only way we can save Cassidy is by blowing up the station. We kid. Right, we love Picard.
Yeah. No, we do love Picard. I mean, if I had to serve under one captain, I think it would be Picard as the captain under whom I would feel most comfortable. But one of the reasons that DS9 is my favorite series is that I like the way Sisko operates as a captain because he takes charge in a way that I think you have to in reality. You know, TNG is all about the utopian ideals that diplomacy can always prevail, but diplomacy really cannot always prevail. Sometimes you have to just, you know, take the harder approach to something and stand up to something. And Sisko does that. And I think that also defines what I like about DS9 and what I like about Sisko. And maybe that's where a little bit of Avery Brooks's crazy comes in that makes Sisko able to do this too.
This episode sort of put us on a new path for DS9, as we've said. And it's interesting to talk about where this led. Obviously, there's the whole Dominion War, but this is part of a larger arc that started before and sort of went after with the changeling infiltration. And I couldn't help but remember how this ends. Obviously, I'm actually trying to remember exactly what it was, but the Klingons at this point had been infiltrated by the changelings, and that's why they're attacking the Cardassians. It wasn't really, I mean,
well, actually, is that the deal? That comes a little bit later.
Yeah, that's much later, isn't it?
What happens here is that the Klingons believe that the Cardassians have been infiltrated.
Okay.
The Cardassian military government has been overthrown and a civilian government has taken over. And the Obsidian Order has been abolished.
Right.
And the Klingons believe that the Cardassian civilians could never overthrow the military government on their own without help. So they believe that the founders, the changelings, have infiltrated Cardassia and have set up like a puppet government, I guess, that they're kind of in charge of the government now.
So this is unrelated to the Klingons being infiltrated.
Yeah, that comes later when Gowron, I believe, is replaced
by a changeling.
That's
what I was thinking. I was thinking this was a changeling Gowron this early in the season. Obviously, this is my DS9 ignorance coming through.
Well, that's the thing about DS9. It is very complex, and I need to go back and watch a few things to be absolutely sure that Gowron at this point hasn't already been replaced by a changeling.
Right.
Because Gowron is replaced by a changeling at some point, and we find out later, but I'm not sure that we know how long he was in place, you know. So as we go back and we kind of watch through these final seasons, we'll go back and find out a little bit more about when all those events take place.
Right.
But what is actually revealed in this episode, however, is that Gowron is simply still Gowron as a chancellor, and the Klingons are going to conquer Cardassia in order to defeat the changelings and prevent the Dominion from getting a foothold in the Alpha Quadrant. That's kind of their whole premise. And
it was Martok. Uh-huh. Martok at this point, because we're going to get letters. Martok at this point had been replaced by a changeling, and he was the one spreading the information throughout the Klingon Empire about the Dominion being behind the Cardassian uprising. So Gowron at this point was still Gowron, but he was getting fed lies by the Dominion. And so, but I don't think, like, at this point in the show, we're not supposed to know that. I don't even know what the writers knew that at this point.
We don't know this yet. Right. That's the thing. At this point, none of that has happened yet. That's all we know is that Klingon intelligence tells them that there's been a change of government on Cardassia, and they think that the Dominion's behind it. So they're going to conquer Cardassia because they think that that is their way of protecting the Alpha Quadrant.
Right.
But so it ends with, of course, DS9. One of the other big changes from the first three seasons of the DS9 is that DS9 now has some defensive systems and has phasers and photon torpedoes and shields and can actually kind of hold its own in a firefight. Of course, it's being attacked by like three dozen Klingon ships here, so the battle doesn't go smoothly, but they're able to hold them off long enough that a Federation task force is about to arrive, and then Sisko convinces Gowron to stand down.
Right.
And that's how it ends. But it also ends with the fact that the Khitomer Accords are now gone, and the peace treaty between the Klingons and the Federation is gone. And so that sets up even though the Klingons and the Federation do remain allies through most of DS9, It's an uneasy alliance. You know, it's kind of right. like it's kind of like the United States and the Soviet Union during the World Wars. You know, they are allies out of necessity, but not necessarily because they agree with each other on things and want to be friends, right. but they need to be. So this kind of took the rosy Klingon Federation relationship of TNG away and exactly. returned us back to the conflict.
Right. I mean, of course, there were episodes like the Trouble with Tribbles, where if there was no outright attack going on between the Federation and the Klingons, so they were sort of putting mm-hmm. up with each other. But
yeah, just a bar fight.
Just a bar.
There's
fight.
A bar fight in every episode of the original.
Exactly.
Series, right?
So I mean, showing a battle between DS9 and the Klingons, really seeing the budget of the show grow mm-hmm. to such an extent has got to be great for people tuning in, especially for the first time, and seeing all this stuff going on and seeing, I don't know, it's just, I feel like fans must have been a little annoyed with what happened to the Klingons in TNG. And
yeah, original series fans yeah. anyway.
And I know Roddenberry had a point. He was trying to show, you know, people can come together. There can be peace between all peoples. And yeah, okay, that's great. And it really is. But also, when you're watching a TV show, you want to have villains. And the Klingons are strong villains because after so many years, they had develop this whole culture. And it's so much more interesting when your villain has a culture than when he's just
yeah, right.
a guy on the view screen with a weird face. That's sort of the problem with Voyager, is that we never
yeah.
got a villain that we really got to know. There was
right. yeah.
there was the Kazon, which
yeah, but
they had no depth. And then there's the Borg, but the Borg just, I mean, on the surface has no depth. It's just that's what they are. They don't have depth.
By their nature,
exactly.
there's no culture that you can develop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So the Klingons, and to a lesser extent, but still kind of there, is the Romulans. They are
yeah.
so rich and so interesting that an episode like this is possible. You couldn't have an episode like this on Voyager with the Kazon, with anybody else. It's simply not possible because the villains just aren't there. And it was really important
yeah,
for DS9 to get back to a place where they could do an episode where the Klingons were the Voyager, because were the villains, because it's tapping into the strengths that Star Trek has. Like you don't spend so long building up a villain and then make them the good guys. You know, you've
yeah,
got to
exactly.
use them. You've got to use them like they're
and
meant to be used.
It's also great in DS9 that later on, even the Romulans start to get fleshed out a little mm-hmm. bit more, and of course DS9 I think is ultimately a Cardassian series where we really get to know the Cardassians. But in the Next Generation, the Cardassians were, like you said, that weird face on the view
yeah.
screen. You know, the Cardassians showed up here and there in the Next Generation, but we never really knew very much about them. And then they get fleshed out here. And the Klingons in DS9 actually appear 49 times.
Oh, wow.
Which is, they appeared 31 times in the Next Generation, mm-hmm. 49 times in Deep Space Nine. So it really became an integral part. And like you said, you need to have a villain. But in the case of Deep Space Nine, we actually end up with a lot of villains. We have the Cardassians, we have the Romulans, we have the Klingons, and we have the Dominion.
Mm-hmm.
And within all of those, we get this very intricate play between all of these different powers, where you never quite know where the relationship stands with anybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's so not only do you have that villain that you need, you have multiple villains.
Yeah.
And then you even get other parties like the Breen that come in
yeah.
during the seventh season, which of course nothing gets fleshed out about the Breen, but it's like you have yet another villain who's working together. It just develops such an intricate story.
It's really interesting. I found something interesting where I was looking at, while I was pulling up Deep Space Nine on Netflix, and the description says that the space station was previously owned by the evil Cardassians. And I just had this like gut reaction of like, well, they're not all evil. Like, you know, you can't just put it like a broad thing over all the Cardassians. And that made me realize, as we're talking now, that the Cardassians are multifaceted. I mean, they are, for the most part, kind of bad.
Yeah.
But there's more to them. If you told me the evil Kazon, you told me the evil Borg, so many of the people on Voyager, and even the Next Generation, the original series to some extent, were just evil.
Yeah.
But on DS9, it's much harder to make those black and white declarations about people, especially an entire race. Even Garak, yeah. I mean, even aciding him, there's, you know, good and bad in the Cardassian Empire, and there's good and bad in the Klingon Empire, and there's good and bad in the Federation. So yep. that's what Deep Space Nine showed, and that's what Next Gen kind of shied away from, and Voyager certainly did. You know,
shied away from it. Yeah, the Next Generation was about showing how perfect the future could be, mm-hmm. and Deep Space Nine shows how we deal with a future reality.
Right,
I would say. Your description there, though, I was just thinking back to back in the day when you would get the TV guide, you know, the printed TV guide, and they only have enough space to write like half a sentence about each TV show that's coming on. I can just see this one, The Way of the Warrior. Sisko gets a new haircut.
That's basically it.
All right. Well, I guess in closing, also as a turning point for DS9, this kind of being like a reset switch for DS9, it established, and again, it didn't do it out of the blue. There were bits and pieces over the first couple of seasons, especially season 2 and 3, of the Dominion, of the Changelings, and of the Bajoran religion as well. But this really, it sets up the threat of the Dominion, especially, which becomes the cornerstone of Deep Space Nine. You know, in the later seasons, mm-hmm. everything revolves around the Dominion threat. And even though we had heard of the Jem'Hadar going back to the end of season 2, this is where I think the Dominion threat truly becomes big, as in it's an Alpha Quadrant problem,
right?
Because you have the Klingons now concerned about it as well. So this sets the stage for the foundation of the great DS9 series that we know over the final 4 seasons, with the Dominion threat and kind of an uncertain relationship and conflict between the major powers in the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah, I love the idea of the stability of the Alpha Quadrant falling apart. It's kind of easy to not worry about the Dominion when you know that, you know, the Federation and the Klingons are allied. The Romulans will come around eventually. You know, there's a certain Alpha Quadrant togetherness that you could sort of rely on until this episode, until you realize that there are like deep cracks in these treaties, in these friendships. Things could fall apart here, and then the Dominion could just walk in and, you know, just, you know, kick their feet up and say, well, this is ours now, because there's nobody left to defeat us.
That's what Sisko tells Gowron, that, you know, this is what they want us to do. This is what the Dominion wants us to do. That Klingons fight Cardassians, you know, Cardassians fight Klingons, Klingons fight the Federation. They, you know, we beat each other up,
right.
And then they can just come right in and take everything. Yeah. And of course, you know, as the series goes on, the Romulans come to this conclusion as well. But their position is to just sit on the sidelines, right, and let it happen. Until we get to that great episode in The Pale Moonlight where Sisko has to trick the Romulans to coming into the war. This is a very geeky little point here, uh-huh. but it is interesting that the Klingons are so concerned with the stability of the Alpha Quadrant when the Klingon Empire is actually located in the Beta Quadrant.
Well, sure.
All the action in Star Trek tends to take place in the quote-unquote Alpha Quadrant,
right.
Even though the Klingons are in the Beta Quadrant, and I guess the Romulans are in the Beta Quadrant as well, but they're kind of like right on the border.
Right.
And the way the lines are drawn up, it's kind of like, did we really think about this when we drew these lines up, when we were, you know, originally deciding that there is an Alpha Beta Quadrant? The way they're drawn up, it kind of looks odd. You know, I think Earth is a bit too close to the border of the Beta Quadrant.
Yeah.
So forth.
I think that's a point that most people who watch Star Trek don't realize. They think the Alpha Quadrant is just where everybody is, and the other
everything you see is the Alpha Quadrant, right? That's what people, how they feel.
And the other quadrants are where, you know, the unexplored regions, and that's just what people assume. So it is extremely geeky a point to make, but it is one that doesn't even come up on the show that often, where they don't ever say, well, we're now entering the Beta Quadrant, or
They don't. Yeah.
I guess the wormhole goes. Now I should even know this. It goes to the Gamma Quadrant, doesn't it?
Right. The Bajoran wormhole goes to the Gamma Quadrant.
Right. And then Voyager was in
the
Delta
Barzon
quadrant,
wormhole goes to the Delta Quadrant.
Right. Right. Yeah. So people do know that the Voyager was in the Delta Quadrant, and they know that that's far away. But I don't think people go much further than that.
Right. Yeah. So. This was a great turning point for DS9. I think our advice, though, for anyone who is just discovering the series, because I see so many people on Twitter who are watching DS9, which I think is wonderful. I think it's something that Netflix has done for DS9, because people watch Next Generation in reruns all the time, but I don't think people watch DS9 in reruns nearly as much. But since Netflix got DS9, I see people tweeting all the time, I'm watching DS9, I'm watching DS9.
Yeah.
I think my advice to people would be start at the beginning, start at season one, even though those first few seasons are not really indicative of the greatness that DS9 came to be. They do contain a lot of really important background material that you need to know in order to understand the final four seasons of the show, especially about who the Dominion is, who the Changelings are, and the whole Bajoran religion, which comes to play such an important part at the end of the series.
Right. I mean, there is a thing to say.
I would go to the beginning and watch through.
Yeah, I mean, we have this problem with, Star Trek series take a little while to find their sea legs. But at the same time, there is a certain value to starting a show off with more traditional types of episodes and sort of, I don't know, practicing, you know, seeing what it's like when we do a show like this with these characters, how does it kind of work? And do a couple, maybe they go on a little too long, but do a couple seasons like that, and then you can really get to how the show should be when they find how the characters really fit together. But the writers need it. I think people need it as they're watching the show to sort of ease into it before they can really start laying down, okay, you need to pay attention, and week to week, this is what's going to happen. And DS9 is a really good example of that, where I think if they'd started out having it be really intense and really you have to pay attention week to week and really get to know these characters and know why they're acting the way they are, it would have been harder to digest. So they sort of eased us into it, and this is the point where the bar is set. And if you've watched the show this far, you're probably going to keep watching, and you can put up with having to watch week to week. And I think it's totally worth it, and it's certainly worth going through those first couple seasons where things aren't the DS9 we love, because as you say, there's so much in there that's necessary. Even if the storylines themselves are not exactly what we love.
Well, Greg, that was fun to talk about Deep Space Nine. We don't tend to talk about it as much on this show as the other series for some reason, which is kind of odd, considering it's my favorite. But The Way of the Warrior is one of the best produced episodes of Star Trek, I think, of all the series. You know, it's up there with, like, Broken Bow, for example.
Yeah,
Of just great Star Trek productions, and I was really glad we could talk about it today.
Yeah, we're kind of cheating. It's like the Dos Equis commercials, you know. We don't always talk about Deep Space Nine, but when we do, we only talk about the best episodes. And I think we've only talked about Emissary and Pale Moonlight in this one. I don't know which one we'll do next, but I'm sure it's going to be another one of the top-rated DS9 episodes. And I'm actually hoping next time we speak about Deep Space Nine, we can do a broader topic. You know, maybe talk about the changelings a little bit, like we did the Romulans a few weeks back.
All right. And I'll ask you, if you were a changeling, what would you turn into?
A sofa, of course.
A sofa. All right. Well, I'm sure our listeners have some thoughts on Deep Space Nine. And like you said, we'll probably get some messages correcting us about our Gowron, Martok, changeling replacement theories.
It's what they want. The changelings want the listeners emailing us. It's what they want.
That's what they want. That's right. And then they can just swoop in and take over the show. They've heard that we have Ketracil White stored up here in the Trek FM studios.
Oh, no.
And they want it. All right. Well, if you do have something to say to us about anything on the show today, you can send us a message by going to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there where you can send us a good old plain text message, or you can leave us a voicemail if you'd like to call us. Just call 646-652-TREK to do that. You'll also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM, and you'll find us on Twitter under the username TrekFM. And Greg, you're also on Twitter.
I am tweeting constantly about various subjects, but trying to talk about Trek as much as possible. So check me out at Greg Harbin. That's GregHarb as in boy, IN.
And you'll find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And also, I wanted to mention, first I want to mention Trek Trivia. If you go to our website at trek.fm/trektrivia, you can play a multiple choice quiz, which has a pad interface. And we have badges at the end. When you win the quiz, I just put up a new quiz yesterday, so it'll actually be the current one when the show comes out, and it's about the movie First Contact. So if you get that one, we have a special Borg Queen badge, which is a little bit different in style than our usual Trek Trivia badges. So hop over and try that. You can also follow username Trek Trivia on Twitter, where Anthony Davis and Mark Stamper do quizzes several times a week. Those are live quizzes. And the other thing I wanted to mention, because we're talking about DS9, Greg, and I forgot to mention it earlier, I put up a new word search the other day with a DS9 theme.
Oh, nice.
And that is, the word search is called Bajoran Tourism. And there are 20 locations from all around Bajor hidden in the puzzle. So if you go over to trek.fm/WS3, that'll take you straight to the Bajoran Tourism word search. And see if you can find places like Bahala, the Fire Caves, and, of course, everyone's favorite, the Kendra Province.
Nice, nice, nice. I don't know if I know enough about the Bajorans, especially the tourism industry, but perhaps if I did this word search, I would know so much more.
That's right. Luckily, it's a word search, not a crossword puzzle, so you don't have to actually come up with how to spell these things.
Indeed.
Well, my medicine is really kicking in here, and I'm slowly losing consciousness. And it may be Dr. Pulaski putting me under the magic history spell. I don't know, but I think I'm going to head out here, Greg.
Oh, no. Well, yes, definitely. I think it's time to stick a batleth in it, because the ready room is done.